there's all sorts of kind of weighed in for different kinds of projects. And you see reflected all the things that you find tabled at the end of this book. Right? It's all happening 20 years before and also before that. So I think it helps us sort of think more through those trajectories. So what's on the walls physically are just different kinds of, this is the DIY version. We're hoping to get funding to make these all, you know, not 10-point font. So this is a kind of introduction to the group, and then I'll take you around some of the kind of issues of transnationalism, stuff on media, stuff on deportations, stuff on lesbianism. And then the maps, this is the international map, so campaigns, a sample of the campaigns that they were covering all around the world. And this is the UK map in Ireland that is covering sort of the activisms that were going on there. And there's a leaflet you can take and some newspapers you can browse through, but please return them. If you want to read up in between sessions. And just if you have any questions at any point, come up and ask me. I'm not a 1980 social movement historian, so I will not necessarily know what all the groups are, but I can speak much more about all sorts of aspects of the project. The only other two things I want to say is first that another part of this project is rethinking the ways that presentations at conferences are delivered. And so why do I necessarily need to read a paper? Why can't I post these things on the wall and talk to you and have you look at them and interact with them and touch them? Something that we don't tend to do at conferences when we're just reading. So for me, it's also a way of thinking about how we can expand and add to what a conference does and how we express and exhibit our academic work so that it can reach broader audiences. And the other thing I want to say is that these two might fall down, especially in England, but as we know, England's been dropping things recently. So. So help yourselves and ask me stuff.
Time for some questions. If anyone's got any questions, then we can start now, otherwise.
It might be more of a point than a question. Have you heard of Anandi Ramamurthy, who was an academic at University of Central Lancashire? She did something very similar with the Asian youth movements, which were sort of left of centre youth movements in most of the big English cities in the 70s and 80s, and got funding, can't remember who from, to digitise basically an archive of newspapers, leaflets, political posters, etc. And really, where they're of interest, especially with my own research, is it shows that the British Asian politics that is broadly secular or was actually sometimes quite hostile towards religion and looked at things like the Middle East very differently to the way it's looked at increasingly now. So I think this type of work gives you a different perspective over what's quite a historically short period of time, maybe 20, 30 years. I've got an email address.
That sounds great, because that's exactly what.
You'll probably have more questions after you actually look at the stuff. Shall we get going? Shall we? Just let you know, the food, before we start, the food is going to stay out there until the coffee break. So if we get packaged later, even though I have pressed on the walls, eaten more than probably stomach, there will still be food out there with coffee served at the end of the session.
All right. Well, welcome to the first session of the conference, and we're lucky enough to have people from three different continents presenting here. Adam Goodwin from the University of Ottawa, Alex Pitcher from Bristol University, and Sharon Brickett from the University of Queensland. And we'll, I think, just go in the order on the sheet, so if we can start with you.
Hi, my paper, if anyone's read it, in the room is entitled Evolution and Anarchism in International Relations, the Challenge of Kropotkin's Biological Ontology. It's part of a larger project I'm doing now for my PhD. I've got basically three objectives that I'm trying to reach with this. The first two are immediate, the third is a longer term. The first is to understand global politics through the perspective of anarchism, specifically Kropotkin's idea of anarchism. The second is to clarify this understanding through the framework of critical realism, or as they refer to it around here, critical realism. And then the third, which is a longer term, is using Kropotkin's biological oncology to reframe larger political debates. And ontology, in case anyone's not really up on the terminology, is the study of what is real, what is reality. My specific approach is I'm adopting Kropotkin's theory of mutual aid to understand social ontology from a holistic perspective. And my arguments are grounded in evolutionary theory, anthropology, primatology, and the biosciences in general. At the moment, I see three entry points into IR. It was just basically for this paper that I chose these. I'll probably expand it later on. The first entry point is a direct critique of the application of sociobiology to shore up realist arguments. This was made in 2000 and 2004 by Bradley Thayer, and others have done it. Sean Long did it in the 1980s, Fukuyama did it in 1999. The second entry point is a prompting, I want to prompt a re-understanding of the anarchy problematique along ontological grounds. And the third is I wanted to introduce the anarchist normative commitment towards post-sovereignty in global politics, which I'm sure everyone wants to do the same here. So just a quick refresher on what mutual aid theory is. I'm sure you've all encountered Kropotkin. Mutual aid theory was written against T.H. Huxley's The Struggle for Existence article in 1888. It was basically Kropotkin's reformulation of the idea that natural selection is driven by intra-specific competition, where organisms compete against each other, which is clearly has Malthusian biases embedded in it, and Darwin has also been critiqued like that. Kropotkin looked at the variability of the ecology in which organisms live that prompts those organisms to actually cooperate more than they do compete. So this, as Michael Glassman writes in 2001, and he does a brilliant review of Kropotkin's theory, he writes that sociability, the ability for organisms to socialize, is primary. That is our primary objective of analysis. So, and to complement this, I'm using critical realism because it meshes so well with Kropotkin, I find. And for those of you that aren't familiar with critical realism, it was adopted by scientific realism by Roy Bhaskar, and it accepts that reality is independent of our knowledge of it. There is an outside world external to our perceptions. It's a very simple concept, but it has profound implications for how we understand science. So critical realism views epistemology, or the study of knowledge, how we come to know things, as historically bound and socially produced. Epistemology has truth values and rationality embedded within it. And by deciding on a certain epistemology in the view of critical realists, we've already settled our questions of ontology. We've already decided what we think is real, and then we decide how we come to know it. But this is flawed because this actually inherently limits our knowledge of what exists in reality. So critical realism makes the fundamental claim that appearances do not exhaust reality. Thus, we can't always rely on empiricism to gain knowledge. Unobservable entities have causal force, and this causal force is enough to establish their reality. In critical realism, social forms pre-exist individuals. And there's kind of an interesting parallel you could probably draw with anarchist thought, the major premise that society precedes the state. So it was the philosophy of critical realism, this meta theory, that prompted me to kind of wed it with mutual aid theory. So when you put them together, you come up with the political implications of deciding what is ontology in the social realm. And if you think that the ontological primary, the Archimedean point of reference from which all analysis, even critique, as much as they wouldn't want to, admit it, has an Archimedean point. And this Archimedean point has primarily been the individual, the self-interested, egoistic actor, where cooperation becomes epiphenomenal between the interactions of individual actors. But mutual aid theory repositions this ontological primary, and it suggests that an ontology larger than the individual, I posit that it's at the species level, but it's really it's more kind of an anarchist ontology, I suppose, to complement Paul Feyerabend's anarchist epistemology. So I posit it's a species level because it seems very arbitrary to limit it to, say, language groups or races or so on. So the implications of this shift of political ontology are really, I find, they're breathtaking, because using the individual as the reference point for understanding social and political interactions has really deterministically led to the same consequences for key concepts in IR, such as anarchy. And this is it. This exists both in classical and structural realism. So when you define anarchy as being chaotic and defined through or kind of actualized through competition, you're inherently internalizing an individual ontology, individualistic ontology. So the first entry point was my critique of Thayer, and I'll try and be quick about this. Thayer, in 2000 and 2004, examined Niebuhr's theological assumption of evil within humans and the Hobbes-Morgenthau metaphysical assumption that humans possess an inherent animus dominandi. Thayer also theorized that there is a biological need to belong to a dominance hierarchy. And I imagine for you, as well as me, I find that very unsavory. He's hedging his theoretical contribution on really positivist scientific methods. And I'm not taking so much, there's a lot to critique about that, but I'm not taking that up immediately. What I'm more concerned about is where he places his ontological referent, and it is on the individual or even the gene. So Kropotkin's mutual aid theory prompts an ontological shift, which is the primary basis of critiquing Thayer's realist conclusions. So thus, if we accept the evidence accumulated in the biosciences, we need not criticize epistemological or methodological choices. Our critique of mainstream political theory is entirely vested in the ontological choices we make. The second entry point is the concept of anarchy in IR, and I'm sure there's plenty of people covering that already. I was particularly fascinated by Milner's argument in 1991 that interdependence is key to understanding anarchy, because it's implicit within all of the IR literature, whether they want to acknowledge it or not. State interaction always takes place within an interdependent fashion. So this state interdependence is not contingent on equitable relations. Thus, it's analytically independent from the concept of anarchy, but equally important in analysis. This is what Milner is saying. But Milner stops short of acknowledging the roots of actor interdependence. What drives states to interact? Why shouldn't states exist in solitary conditions indefinitely? Moreover, that interdependence is taken as something so integral to the study of politics as to be implicitly acknowledged by the most atomistic views of political reality really speaks to the necessity of recognizing its deeply rooted reality. In other words, its ubiquity bespeaks its analytical importance. So by asking questions about the natural emergence of interdependence among actors at any level, it also tacitly recognizes the importance of human sociality to begin with, the tendency for humans to socialize. So where interdependence is as important to understand in politics as hierarchical relationships, then ontology becomes the primary question of political analysis at both the domestic and international levels. So the third entry point, very quickly, was My application of Kropotkin's ontology to understanding the Emancipatory Project, or assisting, I would hope, the Emancipatory Project in critical IR theory, namely critical security studies. So Wynne Jones, Richard Wynne Jones, has noted that the Emancipation Project in critical IR theory is bound by neither a common epistemology nor ontology. So using Kropotkin's biological ontology to move analysis away from the state and back to society is what critical IR theory needs. Ken Booth has recognized this. Kropotkin would answer thus: the state took the historical role of the facilitator of cooperation. In doing so, it also legitimated certain forms of cooperation by way of coercive measures, regardless of the suitability of the circumstances. So Kropotkin also argued that out of this centralizing of cooperative tendencies among humans, there also grew a dependence on authority. And this worked to alienate and atomize individuals under the state structure. So these anarchist-inspired normative conclusions on analyzing politics under such conditions would argue that it's the same coercive state institutions that lead to the unintended consequences of global politics that we are also familiar with, such as war and endemic poverty. Thus, I have to come to the conclusion that in determining these theoretical and practical political considerations, where we choose to situate our ontology, our ontological referent, rather, is really the question that should matter most. Thank you.
So April's here, everybody. It's been great discussion. Why is it doing this? Can't protect the webcam. Oh, that's right.
Paper is entitled provocatively "David Held as an Anarchist Discussed." David Held is Mr. Globalization. He's published just about every textbook there is on globalization, and I guess his overall project is to reconstitute the social democratic compromise in an age of globalization. And what he's trying to do, in a nutshell, is recast the compromise between state, labor, and capital. In an age of globalization. Tendency within anarchist circles is to dismiss Held's work out of hand, and I'm thinking in particular of Richard Day's treatment, very brief treatment, in Gramsci is Dead. But David Held's thought long and hard about the place of the state and autonomy in the modern world order, and I think his work needs engaging with squarely and directly and consistently from an anarchist perspective, because I think it offers us a lot in terms of conceptualising how we might think about world politics from an anarchist perspective. My basic argument in the paper, of course, is that David Held is not an anarchist. Right? There's no question about that. But a more consistent David Heldian political philosophy probably would be. So basically two things then. I want to show how David Held can be read from an anarchist perspective and how this undermines his basic defence of the state, but also how anarchists can draw from and take confidence from things that we take for granted anyway, but which most people don't recognise as being part of the anarchist tradition. Okay, so I can't do everything that's in the paper, obviously, in 10 minutes, so I'm just going to focus on a few things. And the first thing I'm going to look at is Held's concept of autonomy and how that maps onto what he calls sites of power. And what I'll do with each of these cases is show how the anarchists do similar things, okay? And at the end, I'll obviously develop the critique of the state and try and suggest that Held needs to take the anarchists more seriously, as we need to take Held more seriously. Okay, so David Held argues then that
when he started his project, he argued that there were only two traditions of political philosophy that could help us conceptualise the transformation in the modern state in this globalised era, and they were revolutionary Marxism or liberalism, and he found both to be wanting. Of course, he ignored the anarchists completely. So what he decided to do is he took the best from liberalism, as he saw it, and the best from Marxism. And he argued that if we want to have if we want to move beyond these two traditions, what we need is to place the principle of autonomy at the centre of a political philosophy. Again, he argued that this principle is not at the heart of any of the models of participatory democracy which place the active citizen exclusively at their centre. Now, we can debate what citizen means, but I'll argue later on that that's completely incorrect. So his principle of autonomy states that persons should enjoy equal rights and accordingly equal obligation in the specification of the political framework which generates and limits the opportunities available to them. That is, they should be free and equal in the determination of the conditions of their own lives, so long as they do not deploy this framework to negate the rights of others. This framework is classically republican, and what I'll explain later on is that it needs the democratic legal state, for him at least, to make sure that this principle of autonomy can be realised in the modern world order. There are seven sites of power in which he says that this principle would be most useful, and they are the body, so biopolitics, welfare, culture and cultural life, civic associations, the economy, the organisation of violence, and the state. Now, I can't engage with each of these, so basically I'm going to look at the way he plays this principle out in terms of the state. Okay, the rest are, I deal with the economy in detail in the paper. What Held argues then is that for us to realise this principle of autonomy in pre-existing political institutions, I should preface this perhaps by saying that for Held and for other cosmopolitan political theorists, the state is both too small and too big for purpose in the current juncture. It's too small because it can't deal with macro globalised social forces, and it's too big because it can't respond to micro social processes. So what he argues is that the political principle of autonomy can guide us in reconfiguring political order in the modern era. And he argues that the principle of autonomy can produce political empowerment, but for this you need de jure status. Okay, for de jure status you need to be able to have a democratic legal state that can recognise the rights of individuals. And here we have liberal individualism coming in through the back door. Now, I can't do this the justice it deserves, but just a quick quote. In short, democratic public law sets out the basis of the rights and corresponding obligations which follow from a commitment to the principle of autonomy. It sets the forms and limits of public power, the framework in which debate, deliberation and policy making can be pursued and judged, and sets out the rules, laws and so on and so forth. Essentially, the rule of law will be equally binding on all, and the state will enforce it, and as autonomous liberal individuals, okay, and even within our groups, and he goes into this in some detail in his discussion of the economy and in terms of culture, what we need in order to protect these things and in order to be able to realise our autonomy is a democratic legal state. Okay? Considerations of time mean I'm going to have to skip through this rather quickly, but if we keep our focus on the state for a moment, think about the state being too big and too small. There are two principles that he uses here that he thinks will provide the institutional framework that will be able to defend this principle and allow the individual groups to flourish. And these are subsidiarity, cosmopolitanism, and multi-level global citizenship. Subsidiarity is a principle whereby decisions ought to be taken at the level where the consequences of those decisions are most likely to be most keenly felt, and always at the lowest level possible. This has been enshrined into the Treaty of Europe, incidentally, so it's a principle that's well established within both practice and theory. Okay, so he argues that those whose life expectancy and life chances are significantly affected by social forces ought to have a stake in the determination of the conditions and regulation of these. Okay. This points to the necessity of both decentralisation and the centralisation of political power. Okay, because he argues that when you have multiple groups competing against one another, you need a state that can determine the relations between them, or at least enforce the relations that have been agreed between them. He doesn't accept that the state's perfect by any means, but he does argue that the state's central to that. Now, the cosmopolitan project then is this principle of subsidiarity writ global, okay? Because those that are most likely to be affected by multinational corporations in India, for example, ought to be able to determine for themselves the conditions under which those multinationals come into their countries. Okay? And that can only be done through a cosmopolitan framework of international law. And this would produce what he calls a multi-level global citizenship, where people participate and are active citizenships at multiple levels at once. So either at the global level through the UN or through the International Criminal Court or through human rights legislation and so on, but also at the domestic level through local community networks and so on and so forth. And of course, the state. So far, so held. The only thing that I think ought to be flagged up here is the centrality of the state. I'm hoping that a lot of what I've said is ringing everybody's bells already, but I'm just going to state it plainly for everybody. So how does anarchism fit alongside liberalism, socialism, and the principle of autonomy? Well, to quote David Apter in his rather disparaging paper on anarchism, he basically, the only good thing he says about anarchism really is that the virtue of anarchism as a doctrine is that it employs a socialist critique of capitalism with a liberal critique of socialism. And I think this is fairly standard amongst some analysis, political theoretical analysis of anarchism. Richard Falk has argued that anarchism is alive, and I quote, to the twin dangers of socialism. is alive to the twin dangers of socialism and capitalism if pursued within the structure of statism. Okay? Now, this is what Held's ignored. And Canto Sperber, Monique Canto Sperber, who was the director of the École Normale Supérieure in Paris, has argued, for example, that Proudhon was the first liberal socialist. Okay, so what I'm basically trying to say here is that there's a long tradition of anarchism that Held is completely ignored. Autonomy is also at the heart of anarchist political philosophy. I have many quotes in the paper, but two rather telling ones, I think. One by David Graeber, who in his recent book, Direct Action and Ethnography, argues that autonomy is simultaneously the greatest anarchist value and the greatest dilemma. Okay? How to reconcile the individual with the group and the group with groups is central to understanding how anarchist social movements work. And at the heart of that, of course, is this principle of autonomy. Prior to Graeber's writings, I mean, there's a long tradition of anarchist thinking about this, but Robert Paul Wolff's book is probably the clearest political theory statement of this, where he basically argues the primary obligation of man is autonomy, the refusal to be ruled. And he basically argues from a neo-Kantian perspective that a consistent Kantianism and a consistent liberalism takes us to anarchism. And he basically argues the same thing about Marxism too. He has said that he's basically a Marxist as an economist, an anarchist as a political actor, and an economist as well. So, one way in which we can understand how this links and could question Held's presupposition that the state is the locus within which autonomy can best be defended is to reconfigure how we consider the ontology of politics for this purpose. Okay? And I look at Proudhon here, obviously, because that's where I come from. And the key concept here is autogestion. And autogestion is the self-management, basically, worker self-management. For classical anarchism and for many traditions of contemporary anarchism, the key place where we realise our autonomy and can reclaim our autonomy, and ought to be reclaiming our autonomy, is in our place of work. The argument here is not that politics ought to be primary, it's just that politics takes place in the economic realm. And what I want to argue with using this concept of autogestion is that we can take the state out of politics by putting politics back where it ought to be, which is in our place of work, essentially. And the key, two very quick quotes here. I just want to quote from Proudhon and then very quickly from Richard Vernon. It's not in the fraternity of revolutionary citizens, but in the reciprocity among producers that unity is to be sought. Nor is it in the sharing of uniformity of status as citizens that unity is found, but precisely to the contrary, in the diversity of skill and situation that, in making individuals complementary to one another, also makes them cooperative. What Proudhon argues is that once we've established these autonomous self-governing units, and we need to inscribe them and we need to overlay them with our own institutions. But these have to be directly participatory. Okay? This is where autonomy is really realised, in that participatory process in the workplace. And the purpose here, of course, is to take away from the state. Okay? To take away the state's right, or I suppose its self-declared duty to impose political order. So for Vernon, then, civil citizenship as a political value was merely an arrest of the spirit of liberation, whose ends were not political at all. Now, subsidiarity, I would argue, is a quintessentially anarchist concept. I mean, I can't think of a single anarchist who would have disagreed with the definition of subsidiarity that I read out earlier. And it's the essential thing that we need to take from this is that
those that are most directly likely to be affected by decisions ought to be making those decisions for themselves. That's what direct democracy is all about. That's what direct action is supposed to be about, rather than the politics of the demand. It's the politics of the act, as Richard Day puts it. So decisions should be made in a bottom-up way rather than a top-down fashion. And I think this undermines David Held's political ontology. It also makes it more consistent, because if we hold true to this principle of subsidiarity and autonomy, the defence of the state becomes far more problematic. So then the structure of an anarchist polity implies that all decisions be taken at the most appropriate level, because no other level is sanctioned to make those decisions in the first place. And that, I think, is the key contribution there. So just to say something very quick about cosmopolitan governance, and then I'll conclude. So it might surprise you all to know that both Kropotkin, Proudhon, and Bakunin all called for a United States of Europe. This was, of course, as Europe was descending into its crazy phase. They were warning of the problems of unified states, of the agglomeration of political power, of the centralisation, and so on, and argued that a federation of European communities, okay, along the lines of the Swiss constitution, for example, would protect states, and not through the sort of classic security community thing that was talked about during the League of Nations period, but in a much more entrenched, formalised way, like we have in the European Union today. Of course, the purpose for the anarchists was to ensure that project was bottom-up, which ties in rather neatly with Held. And Proudhon's Principle of Federation, published in 1863, is a classic of this period. So he basically argues that natural groups ought to constitute themselves as associations, become directly democratic, federate across functional lines. And that way we realise the autonomy of the individual and the group. And we restrain the state by denying it its main source of income and by making sure that all political autonomy is retained within the immediate group and not divested or given away, essentially. And what we're left with then is what Ken Booth has called a community of communities. And I think that's all I need to say about that. But basically what I'm trying to say there is that cosmopolitanism, Held's version, and the anarchist one, has a lot in common, but we need to undermine the centrality of the state. And I think for this we need to engage with Held directly rather than ignore him. So I guess I've got a couple of quick conclusions, but I'm just going to make two. I suppose that the persistence of anarchism over the last 150 to 200 years shows that the problems of autonomy and liberty of the 19th century have not gone away. So this tells us two things. First, that we need to go back to the 19th century if we don't want to start reinventing the wheel. But it also allows us to use the 19th century and the debates that were being had at those times to say some interesting things to people that are talking today, who are making claims that the current world order is quintessentially different and that it necessitates all sorts of different things and so on and so forth. But the anarchists were warning of precisely the things that we're trying to overcome today through things like the European Union and so on. They were warning about this 150 to 200 years ago, and we need to take much more care to be respectful of their arguments. So, to conclude then, Held is not an anarchist, but a more consistent Heldian political philosophy.
My paper is had its the title change, so from A New International to Overcoming the Cosmopolitan Communitarian Divide Through Anarchism. Levia Campesina and the Principles of Anarchism. The original paper was found to be far too long. I'm still quite interested in that question. But, so, broadly stated, at the beginning of the paper, we were most interested in sort of demystifying anarchism and its philosophical meaning away from its misconception in popular culture as something commensurate with chaos and disorder. And while this is quite elementary for those of us here in the disciplinary mainstream of international relations, the understanding of anarchy as order, as expressed in the famous symbol of anarchism, the A and the O, is something unthinkable and almost dangerous. And it was this misunderstanding of anarchism that sort of led directly into our research puzzle that framed the article. How and why the understanding of political community in international relations was reduced solely to the sovereign state over other non-hierarchical forms of human community. And we saw that this question was keenly reflected in the cosmopolitan and communitarian divide in international relations theory, and a debate that has confined the notion of human community to two polar opposites that can't be reconciled. So on the one hand, cosmopolitan arguments are beset by charges of domination under some unswerving universalism that is said to be washed over human plurality and versed in world politics. But on the other hand, communitarianism is consumed under a contradiction of parochialism that seeks to reduce community and ethics to the local sphere alone. So in our paper, Leah and I contrast communitarianism and cosmopolitanism with anarchism, in which the local and global or the cosmopolitan spheres are viewed as mutually related. And we argue that IR theory could circumvent the conceptual impasse that's now been reached between the communitarian and cosmopolitan divide by taking into account the two key principles of anarchist philosophy, namely mutualism and confederalism. And towards the end, we explore the social movement La Via Campesina as sort of an empirical case that sort of brings out certain anarchist principles. But I should mention that Leah concentrated on that section, so I mightn't be able to answer all of those questions if you have any. So the beginning with the cosmopolitan communitarian divide, that this unproductive debate has unnecessarily hindered theoretical advancement regarding the development of human community. And the central problem of this intractable dispute arises because communitarian ideologies view norm generation is bounded by the local sphere in which social learning, shared norms, relations of solidarity are all deemed to end at the state's border. So such views are largely blind to processes of social interaction and the potential for solidarity that occurs and can occur increasing over the increasingly porous nature of community boundaries within world politics. And yet the tradition of cosmopolitanism, even of the so-called new cosmopolitanists, suffers equally under the imposition of the notion of community that takes the state as its sole referent. So Ulrich Beck and Robert Fine, for example, have attempted to develop the theory of cosmopolitanism through their shared critique of methodological nationalism, which is the belief that the human community naturally inheres in the nation state. Yet because methodological nationalism has never been able to provide a satisfactory account of the state, either normatively or historically, it meant that even Beck's otherwise strident argument for the need to move away from state-centric approaches seemed to too readily accept the historical validity of methodological nationalism and how it set the state at the apex of political community. So in the end, his argument therefore didn't negate nationalism, but in fact presupposed it through its desire to transform the concept into its cosmopolitan form. So by taking up Richard Ashley's method of the double reading, we try to expose this dualism as an unfortunate byproduct of the anarchy problematic, and the author, which is the orthodox or dominant discourse in IR theory. Here, the fact of anarchy as the assumed background condition in world politics, defined by the absence of a central agency to enforce global order, is widely perceived as a foundational truth in IR. It defines the compass of imaginability in political community and forms the reality that anybody that's interested in sort of cooperation in world politics must respect and deal with foremost. So while the anarchy problematic is ostensibly concerned with the problem of anarchy, at the same time it actually endows the state with the privileged status of being the only form of political community that can overcome the problem of anarchy, a view which closes off possibilities for the expansion of and differentiation in human community at both local and global levels. So anarchy becomes the word that the orthodoxy of IR uses to mark off the marginal places and times, and in making this demarcation, renders it a place to be feared and disciplined by the state. Yet from the absence of central rule in world politics, nothing follows as a logical necessity. It could be populated by any type of community. So it does not preclude social cooperation without coercion, as per the Hobbesian imaginary, and nor does it automatically inhere in the egoistic pursuit of individual self-interest, as per the Lockean imaginary. These are possibilities, of course, but only some among many. So what if the condition of anarchy were viewed differently, away from the orthodoxy of the anarchy problematic and away from the assumed primacy of the sovereign state as the only form of human community? And here, alternative forms that accept the ontological mutual relation between individual, local, and cosmopolitan spheres, but without the need for coercive force to maintain the relations between them, could be explored. So this is where we sort of began to look into two key anarchist principles that we thought could highlight and move beyond the impasse between cosmopolitanism and communitarianism, and these were the ideas of mutualism and confederalism. So the ontological and normative commitment of anarchism is diametrically opposed to the Hobbesian imaginary and the tradition of real politics that it spawned and which remains so prevalent in IR theory. So for the Hobbesians, because of its reduction of human behaviour to self-interested and competitive egoism that it presumed would lead to social disorder and violence, the only possible answer was assumed to be the subordination of individual interests under a unifying and all-powerful sovereign authority. And here all the individuals and mere subjects drawn together seemingly under the legitimacy of a fictive social contract, but who are in reality only bound by the constant threat of a social force, or state force. So in distinction, the anarchist, the type of human behaviour that's conditioned by anarchy, is seen to be full of potential for the consolidation of harmonious social relations without the need for coercive authority. So it's not despite the fact that anarchism has no rulership, but because it has no rulership, that is considered a just and orderly social ideal. Though it's exceptionally difficult to categorically state what anarchism stands for and which all anarchists would ascribe to, it can be broadly conceived of a society in which coercive authority is exemplified in the state and capital, are replaced by the free union in all places of work and the free assembly at local and global levels. So that is, anarchism endeavours to establish non-coercive social relations through a reconciliation of universal human solidarity with particular solidarities at the local level. So what holds society together is not the compulsion of law or foresight in government, but our social need for mutual aid, following Kropotkin, which meets with the ability of human beings to make improvements spontaneously to their social organisations. So at base, it's a theory of reciprocation at the social level. So anarchists have long called for decision-making from the bottom up. Here, social organisation and cooperation do not involve the derogation of authority away from the person or community, as takes place in representative democracies, but serve purely administrative functions. So this solidarity collaboration applies within economic and productive relations as well. So mutualism here denotes forms of social engagement and obligation that are derived through reciprocity, voluntary agreement, and free association, which captures anarchism's ability to confirm individual freedom within genuine social relations. So the social ontology of anarchist philosophy maintains that freedom cannot be achieved through isolated independence. They could appear only in a social environment that was dependent on the social ties of free human association. While anarchism lauded negative liberty, the liberation of the individual was held possible only in community, which set up a powerful dialectical relation. One's freedom was seen to be dependent on the freedom of all others and could not be divorced from relations in and across communities. So in this dialectic of community, local communities and global relations between them are considered one. Neither form of community is complete without mutual relations that combine both spheres. And so it's in widening these associations between communities that fed into the idea of the anarchist idea of federalism and also confederalism. So confederalism makes the fundamental connection of the interdependencies between persons, groups, and communities who may live thousands of miles apart, but who nevertheless require special associations between them to ensure internal and external forms of freedom. So specifically, this meant joining of individuals to their local community and places of work through cooperative societies, which are then federated with each other to provide the necessary conditions of support for each local grouping. However, the crucial limitation of classical anarchist thought was that it championed decentralisation without understanding the need for a form of liberatory confederalism and of widening the notions of ethical community to external associations between communities. So it had a tendency to emphasise the local sphere rather than the dimensions of community at the sort of global level, which are equally necessary. So its notion of federalism was somewhat too loose and almost isolationist, and we argue was one of the key factors that led to the defeat of the Spanish Revolution. So in its place, we contend that Murray Bookchin's notion of confederalism is both normatively and organisationally superior to those anarchist views regarding federalism. So Bookchin's idea of confederalism maintains the libertarian ideas of federalism, in which power emanates from the bottom up and is decentralised, yet it also brings together the idea of the grassroots, face-to-face, participatory democracy in the local sphere with the integration of communities that are inevitably independent at regional and local levels. Bookchin reiterates the need for such regional and global integration against both the dangers of local isolationist and cultural parochialism, and also against the universalist mentalities that tend to overlook the uniqueness of different cultural and also ecosystems. So global confederalism is advanced because of the necessity of what he calls vital solidarity between human beings and the shared moral responsibility for our actions that compels the development of cosmopolitan associations in furtherance of each other's of each community's freedom. So in the last section, so turning quickly to the Viola Campesina movement, or the Peasants' Way, we acknowledge that La Via Campesina doesn't mesh or necessarily fit with it all aspects of anarchist philosophy, but we're satisfied there's enough sort of commonalities to draw out such a comparison. So La Via Campesina is considered by many to be the most significant transnational social movement in the world. It's made up of peasant groups and family farm organisations from North America, South America, Europe, Africa and Asia. As of 2007, the movement represented 148 rural social movements, organisations from over 69 countries. And the movement is most notably marked by its diversity in terms of class, gender, ethnic and ideological persuasions of its member organisations. Nevertheless, despite these differences, there are unifying commonalities. Most notably, it represents the economically and politically marginalised sectors and groups. So the fundamental assumption common to both anarchism and La Via Campesina is that the people will spontaneously organise in a way to achieve a lifestyle that sort of reflects the freedom that they desire. And this takes us away from the modernisation theory of industrialisation, or the one-size-fits-all approach to development, to a theory that sort of promotes community rights for the formation of their own developmental frameworks. So instead of mere economic solidarity based around the pursuit of material ends, La Via Campesina provides for an enhanced form of human community that doesn't look to the narrow interests of just economic oppression, but towards the anarchist ideals of complete liberation and emancipation in all spheres of life. So it doesn't just deal with those economic questions, but also social justice, ecology, and communal freedom. So its key platform, or its slogan, is "We have a world to gain," and that, which captures it eloquently. It's look to beyond the catastrophe of market liberalisation and a return to sort of agrarianism, communal relations and ecological sustainability. So the alternative framework that it does put forward is what they have called food sovereignty. Okay, so food sovereignty refers to the rights of peoples and communities to define their own unique, culturally specific, social, ecological and economically appropriate forms of agriculture, labour and food production, and also land. So I'm running out of time here, but just one last point. So it also reflects, so La Via Campesina also resonates with anarchism through its non-hierarchical or bottom-up approach to community that is autonomous, pluralist and multicultural. So in this context, national and regional movements within Via Campesina are part of a wave of social movements that have broken free from paternalistic political party sponsorship and also state control. So La Via Campesina is independent and strives for its independence, not only from all political parties, governments, funders, and also NGOs, so that the movement remains uncompromised by any external political or economic affiliation. So I guess I'll have to leave it on that point.